Mr. Drennan, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Fundamentally, Your Honors, this appeal is about the separation of powers and what department of government decides the law. That matter was settled over 200 years ago in Marbury versus Madison. The judicial department decides the law. In this case, a case of extraordinary importance, not only to my client, Your Honors, but because of what the executive branch is trying to do. What the executive branch is trying to do is to indulge in an unwarranted and unconstitutional accretion of its power, the prerogatives that it deigns to have, in creating or identifying law. What it is trying to do is to say that the law in this country is that a foreign official from a failed state, such as my client, ought to be sued by a U.S. citizen because the executive says so, without any reference whatsoever to the common law and outside of any matrix of the common law. We recognize that the separation of powers is an important doctrine. It's a critical doctrine. What separation are we talking about here? We're talking about what is the preserve of the executive and what is the preserve of the judicial department. The executive has the prerogative of deciding questions relating to foreign policy. In a sense, in some oblique sense, that is what they're purporting to assert here. However, they go on to talk about how important it is that as a matter of policy, that U.S. citizens be allowed to sue U.S. residents. In fact, the statement of interest states that explicitly. What is the purpose of the separation of powers? Purpose of the separation of powers is to, among other things, recognize distinct spheres of competence and responsibility under our constitutional form of government. The judicial department determines what the law is. The executive department, with its State Department, embassies, officials around the world, has a unique sense of competence and prerogative to assert American interests abroad. What the government does not say in its statement of interest or in its brief is that somehow it would be offensive to the prerogatives of the government for the court to make the appropriate determination as to my client's claim of common law immunity. It does not say that. And because it does not say that, we are not dealing with the specter of antagonistic jurisdiction, an appellation that's used in one case. In other words, were this court to recognize that my client has indeed a valid claim of common law immunity from suit, would that embarrass the executive department? No, it would not embarrass the executive department. Would that cause any disrespect of this country around the world? No, it would not. Au contraire, what it would do is to stand as a testament that this is a country of laws.
Do you have any authority on which we can find guidance if we accept your analysis?
Your Honor, this is the, to answer your question, as the government points out in its statement of interest, this is an extraordinarily unusual situation. To our knowledge, no court has ever been confronted with the situation that we're dealt in this case, namely, an official from a failed state who claims common law immunity and the government comes in with a statement of interest that this person should be subject to suit. We've never confronted this before.
Let me ask it this way then. Is there authority to which you can point us in which courts have not acceded to the State Department's views regarding whether a foreign official is entitled to immunity?
Not to our knowledge. However, Your Honor, I would add a commentary to that. Again, emphasizing that we have never been confronted with the situation. We've never been confronted with a situation in which the executive department files a statement of interest and deigns to decide what the law here should be. And I refer now to the joint appendix at page 71, page 7 of the statement of interest. This is an extraordinary statement, referring to the executive's assessment that it is appropriate in the circumstances here to give effect to the proposition that U.S. residents, like Samantar, who enjoy the protections of U.S. law ordinarily should be subject to the jurisdiction of our courts, particularly when sued by U.S. residents. What business does the executive have making that determination? That determination needs to be made by the Judicial Department. That decision, appropriately, should have been made by the District Court. However, in its order, which tellingly followed the statement of interest by one day, the statement of interest was filed on Valentine's Day, and the very next day, the court basically said, in a sense, and I'm paraphrasing here, the executive has ruled. The executive has ruled. That's essentially what the court said. And that's not the prerogative of the executive. The prerogative of the executive is to weigh foreign policy considerations. We cite, for instance, the Peru case, where it was important that the court not be seen as causing embarrassment to the executive department. How would a decision of this court remanding this case to the district court and having the district court making an assessment as to what the law is in this case, what the common law is, how would that embarrass the executive department? Presumably,
Well, it's not just a question of embarrassment. It's a question of interference with foreign relations. Maybe not in this particular case, but, I mean, overall and generally speaking, you know, that's what the concern is.
It's not a stated concern of the executive that it is necessary for Samantar to be subject to suit. If we would concede, Your Honor, Judge Traxler, we would concede that were this statement of interest to have included a phrase that it is the determination of the executive department, for instance, that Samantar, it is in the interests of the United States that Samantar be subject to suit, and that Samantar, that this is an appropriate and a proper determination because of the foreign policy interests of the United States. Those last few words, we concede, would be dispositive. They don't say that. You can read.
Not taking issue with their authority to do what the government did in its statement of interest. You're taking issue with the stated rationale.
I want to back up a bit, Your Honor. I am, respectfully, I am taking issue with what the government did, because what the government did is the government deigned to state what the common law ought to be in this country. And by doing that.
You refer to the government, you're referring to who?
I'm referring to the executive branch. Because the executive branch, in its statement of interest, by the phrase that I just read to the court, deigned to state what the law ought to be in this country. And that is not the call of the executive. That's the call of the judicial department. And this
that
case.
In the proposition that you're arguing against, consistent though with the Scudery Change case back in 1812, and you're talking about language from Marbury versus Madison, which preceded that.
I am indeed, Your Honor, but what I...
Justice Marshall was involved in both of them.
Both of them, and he was right down the street from here before he became the Chief Justice. Your Honor, obviously the executive, if it makes a positive determination that immunity ought to be granted, it's the call of the executive. The district court's divested of jurisdiction. But the corollary to that, that the specter of where the government says that immunity ought not to be conferred on a given official who's from a failed state, never been confronted with that before. It's the first time. I note that
By the focus of your objection is that the government, that the executive can say when an individual should be entitled to immunity, but not that an individual should not be entitled to immunity. Is that the distinction you're making?
That is partially correct, Your Honor. And if I might be indulged to answer that, I see the time has run out of the water clock here for me here. Obviously, as I just stated, the government does certainly have the prerogative of stating that a given official is entitled to immunity. However, it's not the prerogative of the government to say, ipsy dixit, that a given official is not entitled to immunity, thereby removing the case from an assessment of what the common law principles ought to be. If, however, the government states that this determination or statement of interest that immunity ought not to be conferred on a given official is couched in an assertion that it is necessary for the foreign policy interests of the United States to be advanced, then I would concede that the government could do that. But that is not what we're confronted with here, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
You've got some time reserved.
I do, Your Honor.
Now let's hear from the government.
Thank you.
Mr. Tyson, did I say that right?
That's right. May it please the court, my name is James Tice, and I'm here on behalf of Bashi Youssef and the other appellees. Your Honors, the question presented is whether the district court was correct to deny common law immunity to Mr. Samantar in this circumstance against the serious allegations of torture and extrajudicial killing and other war crimes. Now, as Your Honors just asked my colleague, the separation of powers concerns implicated here make no difference whether it's a suggestion of immunity or a denial of immunity. In other words, the issues in which the executive branch considers in evaluating a foreign policy impact of a decision makes no difference whether the suggestion is for or against immunity. Now,
and your authority goes back to where?
It goes back to the Supreme Court, Your Honor. In National City Bank versus China, the Supreme Court said that because the State Department was the responsible agency for the conduct of our foreign affairs, it is the normal means of suggesting immunity, and its failure or refusal to suggest immunity has been accorded significant weight by this court. And all the other courts of appeals that have addressed that specific question of what it means when a State Department or an executive branch determination is to not afford immunity have all found that that determination is equally deserving of significant weight and deference.
Do we have any problem with jurisdiction here?
Your Honor, no. We believe that this this court has jurisdiction over the order as under the collateral order doctrine. Traditionally, foreign sovereign immunity has been evaluated or jurisdiction has been taken under the collateral order doctrine. Obviously, in light of Al-Shamari last week, the en banc decision, which touched on collateral order, that issue has not been briefed, but we would submit that the that decision recognized in footnote number 9 that immunities, such as qualified immunity, are those immunities like qualified immunity with a good pedigree and a long pedigree in the law are typically are typically appropriate for collateral order review. In particular, this collateral order doctrine, foreign sovereign immunity has been recognized for over 200 years under the common law.
What about the what happened after in the district court after this ruling?
Your Honor, yes, the
things there that I don't fully understand.
Your Honor, Samatar entered default as to liability and as to damages. At this point, no default judgment has been entered. It is unclear from the district court. The way we understand the law is that the default has, he's admitted all well-pleaded allegations in the complaint, and he has waived any defenses he might have. It was unclear from the district court's the hearing in the matter whether or not the district court had understood him to waive this appeal or his common law immunity defense. Again, that
is that an issue for the district court or for us?
Whether or not he had waived it.
Yep. Whether or not there's jurisdiction. I mean, does that impact on our status here, or is it moot, or what's going on?
Your Honor, until the default judgment is entered, we don't believe it's moot. If he has waived it, then we do believe that with the entry of a default judgment, it would be mooted. However, again, it was unclear.
So, why is the default judgment being delayed? In order to get us to rule on the legal issue?
It is unclear, Your Honor, why the default judgment. The district court held a hearing on damages and has yet to enter the order. We don't know why.
There's been a damage inquiry proceeding.
There has been
evidence taken.
Yes, evidence taken.
But no, have the parties briefed the case or the damages issues post-hearing or anything?
Mr. Samatar did not contest damages and did not appear at the damages hearing to put on evidence as to damages.
Is it like an ex parte proceeding?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
In your brief on page 19, you said, referring to the district court, in doing so, the district court was explicit that it was not reflexively deferring to the executive branch's determination of Samatar charges. The court correctly explained that the United States position does not control the determination, and it independently considered with care not only the statement of interest, but also the position of the parties as presented through extensive briefing. Is that still your position?
It is, Your Honor.
That the court makes an independent decision regardless of the position taken by the United States?
We do, Your Honor, and we think that that is actually what this court did in Doe No. 700. When it was confronted with a head of state immunity claim, this court first looked at the principles in the common law, as the Supreme Court commanded in this case, the principles in the common law that relate to head of state immunity. When it found that the specific question in that case was not answered by the head of state immunity doctrine as it understood it from the common law, it looked at the principles underlying the rationale behind that doctrine, and it determined that because that doctrine is extended as a matter of grace and comity among nations, it's meant to facilitate international relations, as this court held when this case was last on appeal. It is, again, it's to protect international relations and our national interest. And so in those circumstances, it determined that the current government could, in fact, waive the immunity of a former sovereign and decided that it did not need to decide whether or not to defer to the executive branch's determination in that case, which was to deny immunity. And we think the exact same analysis can apply here. We think that Mr. Samatar does not enjoy immunity under traditional principles of the common law, under either head of state immunity, which is only afforded to current officials and not former ones, nor official act immunity. For his acts, we think we're far outside any actual any law.
What weight do we give the State Department's position?
Well, the Supreme Court, Your Honor, said in National City Bank versus China that the Supreme Court is to be given, or the executive branch determination is to be given significant weight. Now, clearly, that's a very highly deferential standard. As my colleague told Judge Duncan, there's no precedent on point of any appellate court ever overturning a district court determination. And that is in accord with an executive branch determination and with a political branch determination, Your Honor, because this is a matter of the common law. The common law is informed by both the executive branch and the legislative branch. And in that circumstance, we need the court is to take an independent look, but still give very significant weight and very deferential weight given the constitutional dimensions of the question. Now, in this situation, there is no dispute between the political branches. The political branches are speaking with one voice. The executive branch has suggested immunity, and my clients have brought suit under statutes that have been passed by Congress, one of which is the Torture Victim Protection Act, which Congress was very clear was meant to not afford safe haven to torturers and those who extrajudicially kill and then choose to reside, as Mr. Samatar did in the United States for 15 years. In this circumstance where the district court, I would also like to point out, Your Honor, that the district court, my colleague mentioned that this was a separation of powers concern, but the district court here did independently evaluate it. We don't think this was absolute deference to the executive branch. In the sense that it took no role. It did look at the question independently. It noted certain factors, found the executive branch determination to be sound, recognized that the residence of the defendant was a factor to be taken into consideration, and more importantly, the status of the foreign government. The status of the foreign government, again, as in Doe No. 700, goes directly to the important question of the rationale behind the immunity in the first place. And if a government, as in this situation, this highly unusual circumstance, in which there is no, Mr. Samatar is a former official of a collapsed state with no government currently recognized by the United States, and no government to assert immunity on his behalf, to waive immunity on his behalf, or even to opine on whether or not his actions were taken in an official capacity. In that unusual circumstance, we think it is entirely reasonable for the district court to make a determination that's in accord with both the executive branch determination and with with Congress's judgment that such actors who reside in the United States should not be given safe haven. In addition, Your Honor, I want to point out that, Your Honors, that it doesn't make any sense to distinguish between a suggestion of immunity and a denial, or a suggestion of no immunity, as Mr. Samatar contends. And this is a case in point in two respects. For one thing, as both the Statement of Interest and the State Department's letter point out, there are two competing putative government entities in Somalia right now, the transitional federal government in the south and the government of Somaliland in the northwest. And each one of those governments has sought to intervene in respect to the defendant, or the appellant here. One of them has sought to waive immunity, and one of them has sought to assert immunity on his behalf. So we really think that this is certainly a situation where serious foreign policy concerns are implicated by a decision either way, to either give credence to one side's wishes or the other. We think that is clearly a foreign policy impact that could cause embarrassment to the executive branch in either decision. There's also another foreign policy interest that's implicated by this case, Your Honor, and that is that the United States, as the United States told the Supreme Court in this case, in its amicus brief, the United States condemns grave human rights abuses, this is on the first page of their amicus brief, of the kind alleged in the complaint, and it has a strong foreign policy interest in promoting the protection of human rights. Again, this is a judgment that has been echoed by Congress in passing the Torture Victim Protection Act. These are strong foreign policy concerns that the U.S. has, and I think it is simply not accurate to say that the United States United States' decision here did not take into consideration those foreign policy interests, as it said in its brief, in its statement of interest to the court.
Could I follow up on that for just a moment? It seems to me, though, that an argument could be made that a suggestion of non-immunity is a reflection of the fact of the extent to which the executive has indicated that those foreign policy implications that you refer to do not come into play, and that therefore the inquiry kicks over into the judicial realm for consideration under the auspices of statutes like the Torture Victims Protection Act. Is that not an argument that can be made to support a distinction?
Your Honor, that is an argument that can be made. I believe it is the argument that the appellant made. But for the reasons we mentioned, we don't think it's accurate.
I understand that you don't agree.
Of course. But for a few reasons. For one thing, again, the Supreme Court and all the other courts that have considered the question have held otherwise. They've said that the failure or refusal is given significant weight suggesting immunity is given significant weight. Just as recently as 2004, the Seventh Circuit said that to grant or to deny a grant of immunity is a foreign policy consideration that's freighted with foreign policy concerns. And again, this case really drives home the point in that a decision to deny immunity here is a foreign policy judgment to the world that the United States can become a safe haven for those who torture and commit extrajudicial killing elsewhere. It is also a determination that in this collapsed state, that is the current state of Somalia, where there's no recognized government, the United States is taking the sides of of one government entity versus another. I mean, both of those, again, just as a factual matter, have profound foreign policy repercussions and could cause embarrassment to the executive branch. As a legal matter, too, in Rich v. Navier, this court said that separation of powers concerns require that this court to assume that the executive branch has taken into consideration all the relevant foreign policy considerations when it
could I ask suggests. That, and I wanted to ask this of the government as well. At what step of the analysis do we consider the suggestion of the assertion of non-immunity? The Supreme Court talks about a two-step process in which you first look to the suggestion of immunity if made by the State Department is dispositive. At what point in the analysis do we consider this assertion that immunity is not appropriate?
Your Honor, I would submit that it would be the same, would be at the same time.
That it's equal.
When the executive branch intervenes, unless I'm misinterpreting your question.
Well, but if that's true, then it would be dispositive, and then there would be no reason, as I understand it, to kick into the second part of the analysis, which the district court clearly conducted, about whether it is judicially appropriate.
Well, Your Honor, again, I'd point you to Doe number 700, again, where I think the court was confronted with a situation where it had a suggestion of no immunity by the State Department. In that situation, the court, again, looked at the principles articulated as the head of state immunity. It looked at the foundational reasons why we afforded in the first place. And then it found because the decision was in accord with the common law, as it's been interpreted by courts of appeals and the Supreme Court cases it cited, and it was fully in accord with the foundational reasons why we have in the first place, it therefore decided it did not even need to determine whether or not to defer to the executive branch in that situation. And particularly in a situation like this where these determinations are so freighted with separation of powers concerns when there are issues with how much deference to afford, and other questions like that. We think it's fully appropriate for this court to do, as it did in Doe number 700, and take a cautious approach and simply say that the district court's determination was fully in accord with the common law here and should be affirmed on that basis. And it's particularly striking in this case, Your Honor, again, where it is a former official of a collapsed state, and there's no recognized government there. Under the circumstance, it is hard to imagine that the executive branch's determination to suggest or to deny immunity, let me put this another way. As the court noted in Doe number 700, and again recently in this case, when the last time this appeal was before this court, the immunity is not an individual right. It is owned by the foreign state. So in a situation as we have here, where the foreign state, or the privilege is extended to the foreign state, and there's no foreign state there to either accept or deny immunity, or to waive immunity on the Mr. Samatar's behalf, there would be no reason not to affirm the district court's denial of common law immunity and allow this case to proceed, given that there is no given that there's not even a foreign government to extend the privilege to in this situation. I'd like to make one other point, Your Honor, and that is that the Torture Victim Protection Act makes clear that this country will not be a safe haven to those officials who torture and commit extrajudicial killing elsewhere. I would submit that there's no authority cited by Mr. Samatar, and none that we have found that would allow this court to reverse a district court's decision that was fully in accord with the common law and fully in accord with the considered views of both political branches, which, as the Supreme Court noted in Verlinden, are the branches of government that are constitutionally committed to the foreign relations power. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Hear from Mr. Yellen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Louis Yellen here today on behalf of the United States. I'm from the Department of Justice. If I may, Your Honors, I'd like to start by talking about a distinction which I think may have been lost in the presentation that's been given to the court thus far. Foreign official immunity is critically different from other types of immunity that the court is likely very familiar with, domestic types of immunity. As counsel for the appellees mentioned, foreign official immunity is not a personal right of an official. It's a subset, it's a component of foreign sovereign immunity, that is the immunity of the state. That's why it's recognized that foreign states may waive the immunity of their officials if they choose to do so. Now, the Supreme Court has explained in multiple cases, Altman is an example, Dole Food is another example, Verlinden is another example, that foreign sovereign immunity is a matter of grace and comity, which embodies judgments about current political realities and may take into account the foreign relations interests of the United States. For that reason, when the political branches articulate principles of sovereign immunity, it's quite appropriate for them to embody, to include in those principles, in deriving those principles, foreign relations considerations. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which codifies foreign state immunity, clearly does that in various respects.
So, I mean, it would not, so I take you to be answering the question that I posed to counsel that preceded you, that it is, that the State Department determination in this regard is to be given great weight in the context of the second part of the analysis, not dispositive, as is a suggestion of immunity, but to be considered in the judicial determination as to whether the requisites for immunity exist?
With respect, Your Honor, I think that's not quite right. I think it's part of the first step. There is no difference between a determination that a foreign official is immune and a determination that the foreign official is not immune.
Well, then you would be saying that it's dispositive.
Yes, we do say that, Your Honor, and I can give you.
If you disagree with his position.
We do, Your Honor. The second, the very end of our brief.
But I want it clear.
Yes, Your Honor. The very end of our brief, I think, articulates that distinction. And if I may give you both a conceptual and a precedential reason.
And if I could just
yes, of course, Your Honor.
To help inform your answer, it appears to me that the Supreme Court's decision in Samatar explicitly recognized that dichotomy. So you would need to tell me why your analysis supersedes that.
Of course, Your Honor. Actually, I don't think it supersedes it. We have a different reading, which I'll explain to Your Honor. We think it's fully consistent with that. The term suggestion of immunity is a device to, it refers to the document that the United States files informing the district court of the State Department's determination. In Hoffman, which is Hoffman v. Republic of Mexico, one of the seminal cases before the FSIA was enacted concerning foreign sovereign, foreign state immunity, that case, the State Department declined to assert immunity on behalf of Mexico. It was referred to as a suggestion of immunity, and the Supreme Court in Hoffman itself found the State Department's determination, decision not to assert immunity, dispositive. And in Samatar itself, in the Supreme Court's decision here, the court explained that in what is what Your Honor correctly referred to as the second step of the process, when the State Department does not appear to present its views, the court explained that in that circumstance, courts may make a determination as to whether immunity should attach or not, but it has to do so, a court has to do so, according to the principles articulated by the State Department. Now, if a court, in making its judgment, must make that judgment according to the principles articulated by the State Department, then it isn't the case that the court is making an independent determination against some free-floating standard that the court itself determines. Now, again, Samatar, we think, is quite explicit that the State Department's determination of non-immunity governs, but if there's any question, I urge Your Honors to take a look at Hoffman, in which the State Department, as I said, did not recommend immunity, and the state and the Supreme Court in that case said it would be just as much an embarrassment to recognize immunity when the State Department has declined to do so as it would be to deny immunity when the State Department has asserted it. So,
could the district court consider whether or not the suggestion of non-immunity is in accordance with the State Department's established policy in that regard?
No, Your Honor, because that would, in effect, the State Department's policy may change over time. And if I may refer back to the original framing as I started this, foreign official immunity and foreign sovereign immunity necessarily include judgments about the foreign relations interests of the United States. It's not courts that make foreign relation judgments. It's the political branches, Congress in enacting statutes, and the executive branch in making assertions of this sort. Now, the foreign relations—
Do you realize that your formulation does heighten the concern, the separation of powers concerns?
Your Honor, I don't think it does, because the separation of powers commits the foreign relations to the executive branch and Congress. And in the absence of a statute, it would be inappropriate for a court to try and discern what the proper foreign relations interests are of the United States. And since as far back as the Schooner Exchange in 1812, the Supreme Court recognized that the executive's participation in these cases is justified.
Although presumably the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the Torture Victims Protection Act are such statutes.
The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act certainly is. It created a congressional embodiment of the principles that are established. And of course, Congress, like the executive branch, has a share of the foreign relations powers. That's perfectly fine. There isn't a statute governing foreign official immunity. I disagree, Your Honor, that the Torture Victim Protection Act is equal to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Torture Victim Protection Act creates a right of action. And just like 1983 creates a right of action, but doesn't have any bearing necessarily on qualified immunity, for example, an official may be entitled to qualified immunity notwithstanding the existence of a right of action under 1983. So similarly, the creation of a right of action in the Torture Victim Protection Act is simply not dispositive of the question of whether or not an official is entitled to immunity despite the existence of that act. Now, of course, here we determined, the State Department determined that Mr. Samatar is not entitled to immunity. And there's one point that I think in terms of this court's disposition of this particular appeal that I think is quite critical. Mr. Samatar's counsel, if I heard him correctly, conceded that if the State Department had made a determination that the foreign policy interests of the United States support a determination of non-immunity, that would be dispositive. Well, I'd like to refer, Your Honors, to the suggestion, to the letter from the legal advisor to the Department of Justice, which I don't have the exact page, but it's somewhere around Joint Appendix 70. It's the attachment.
I do think he retreated a little bit on that, because he said that the suggestion of the suggestion has to be couched in grounds that implicate foreign policy concerns, not dissimilar to those articulated here. And I'm not personally arguing with you. I think that that's
of course I don't mean to suggest
statement of his.
And of course, counsel can clarify if I've misstated, but I just do want to draw this court's attention to this particular the second page, the last paragraph of the letter from the legal advisor says, in light of these circumstances, taking into account the relevant principles of customary international law and considering the overall impact of this matter on the foreign policy of the United States, the Department of State has determined that Defendant Samatar does not enjoy immunity. Now, it can't be that Mr. Samatar's complaint is that the State Department did not fully articulate its foreign policy concerns, because it cannot be that a court would require the State Department to publicly state all of the foreign policy concerns that go into its determination, since the foreign policy concerns are those of Congress and the executive branch and not the judiciary to review. You have a representation here from the Department of State that it did, in fact, take into account the relevant foreign policy interests of the United States. And whether or not counsel has conceded that point or not, I do want to emphasize that for the court. I would also like to correct, if I might, one, I think, misimpression. The district court did not, in our view, simply give great weight to the executive branch's determination here. In the transcript of a proceeding, the district court said, well, the executive branch's determination is entitled to weight, but I'm considering this. In her more formal order denying the stay that Mr. Samatar sought here, the district court was quite explicit in saying that the executive branch's determination here is controlling. We think it's that formal statement that is consistent with the Supreme Court precedent in this case and all of the prior precedent concerning the FSIA that the Supreme Court relied on in the other matters. My time is up, but if I might, I'd like to say a word about this court's appellate jurisdiction.
Real short.
I would just say, Your Honor, that we do think that foreign official immunity is an immunity from suit. It is a right not to to stand trial, and it is separate from the merits. And we do think, as appellees have suggested, that footnote 9 is in the Al-Shamari opinion is the appropriate vehicle appropriate framework for thinking about it. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Drennan.
Yes, Your Honor. It's important to see this this case in terms of what the state the statement of interest was submitted. There was a 10-page memorandum called Statement of Interest of the United States of America, with a 2-page attachment being the letter from the legal advisor at State that counsel just quoted from. The statement of interest of the United States, as we emphasized in our opening argument, talks about the statement of interest of the United States in terms of the policy interests of the U.S. citizens having the prerogative of being able to sue individuals who live in the United States. And that's a determination that needs to be made by the district court. There's been much talk by both of my colleagues about the putative analysis that was conducted by the district court. Respectfully, the district court conducted no analysis. The district court viewed this determination as being a call from the
the executive branch. And further to that point, I just read from the underlying order itself at page 79 of the joint appendix. The government has determined that the defendant does not have foreign official immunity. Accordingly, defendant's common law sovereign immunity defense is no longer before the court. That is the fundamental point at which the government, when I say government, of course, I mean the executive, has overstepped the bounds of its authority and prerogatives under the separation of powers doctrine. Now, there's a point made in response to queries from the court about jurisdiction. I think it's apparent from representations from both of my colleagues that the court has jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine. However, as a backdrop, I think it's noteworthy that in the court also queried counsel about the posture of the proceedings in the district court below, with some query about why the court has not entered judgment yet on the underlying ex parte hearing that was held on damages. I would offer this point. I am counsel of record for a companion case that's before Judge Brinkema, in which the same counsel is representing the plaintiffs in that case, involving another Somali official, Colonel Yusuf Abdi Ali. And in that case, counsel agreed a consent motion that was submitted to the court that those proceedings be stayed in light of the recent developments in the Supreme Court in the Kayobel versus Royal Dutch case, which dealing with the issue of extraterritoriality and the Alien Tort Statute, for which the court extraordinarily has directed re-argument and issued a new question presented about whether or not American courts have any business hearing these cases. And so that case has been stayed by the district court. And again, at the risk of some speculation, that may account for the fact that no judgment has been entered thus far. Immunity is owned by the foreign state.
Do you agree that if there's a judgment entered up there, that moots this?
Absolutely not.
Well, your colleague just made that point there.
Absolutely not, because what we're talking about immunity.
See if you accept his proposition.
We're talking about immunity from suit, and if.
Well, it wouldn't be any suit. You confessed.
Wait, Your Honor, could forgive me if Your Honor could re-propound the question to me.
I believe that your colleague there represented that if there was a judgment entered, that he thought everything would be moot here. It's over with.
Absolutely not. We
defaulted. We didn't do anything.
Defaulted in respect of the proceedings from which he should not have been subjected to in the first place. If that were to be the case, then the denial of a stay.
I'm taking up your time. What you got is you got a pretty good argument if there's collateral order jurisdiction that probably prevents the district court from going forward. Maybe the district jurisdiction's here and it's not there.
I believe that it is. I believe that the appeal properly considered divests the district court of jurisdiction, so that the jurisdiction concerning this matter is right here and not there. And Your Honor may. I defer to Your Honor's interpretation of that. The proposition has been stated that immunity is owned by the foreign state and not the individual. We agree with that proposition, but as I emphasized earlier, we're confronted with this extraordinary situation in which the state for which my client served no longer exists. And there is some discussion in the statement of interest about these competing purported suggestions or pleas from competing governments, neither of which is recognized by the United States, and they're somehow in equal pose. But the simple underlying fact is that at the present time, the United States does not recognize any government over the territory of Somalia. And I see my time is about to run out, but I'll wrap up in just about 10 seconds or so. This is not a situation in which the United States is deigning to act as some sort of trustee, basically waiving Samantar's immunity. It's purporting to make its own declaration, and that's a very important distinction. And to the extent to which the court is concerned about precedential impact of a decision favorable to Samantar in this case, we would point out that the universe of cases for which a narrowly framed decision might apply is vanishingly small. We're just talking about, to my knowledge, two other cases, Ali, Doe versus Ali, which I adverted to earlier, and the other case is a case out of federal court in Ohio involving another Somali official. To my knowledge, and I'd be more than happy to supply the court with a memorandum referencing those two cases. To my knowledge, there are no other cases. And it's these underlying principles regarding the extent to which the executive can go in asserting prerogatives is so important that a favorable decision to Samantar is imperative here. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Drennan. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our next case.